This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics, a podcast to prep you with understandable political chatter for your next cocktail or dinner party this weekend. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Every week, Jay and I get together at our favorite place to talk politics. We hope that you'll be one of the thousands of people who have downloaded Party Politics, and we hope that you will leave us a review because it helps other people join the party. Well, Jay, we've had an eventful week, a lot of things happening at the White House, a lot of things happening abroad.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about changes in the White House, sort of key personnel getting shuffled out. But the one that people probably never talk about very much is Mr. Dubuque, the White House communications director. Well, it turns out he was forced out, resigned. He is famously Sean Spicer's technical boss. And so Spicy stays, but Dubuque has been rebuked.
I like that. You should be a headline writer for like the New York Daily News, right? The White House communications office is really the rudder for the messaging from the White House. And so this is an inopportune moment to have a lack of direction from the White House's message. But obviously, this is a precursor of a kind of larger shakeup. If this is the end of the shakeup, that's one thing. But if it's at the beginning, then they need to do this quickly to be able to get some kind of momentum towards whatever they want to say about what's happening economically, in terms of legislation, and in terms of the scandal.
It also probably, I think, points to the fact that while we like to sort of point fingers at Sean Spicer for some of his misstatements, I think some of that comes out of the environment that the communications office itself is somewhat dysfunctional, and this probably is an attempt to kind of right that.
Well, continuing the theme of White House reorganization, we have the White House this week also suggesting that they are going to require disclosure when administration officials are working in areas that they once lobbied. What do you make of this?
Well, it's good. I mean, I think transparency is something that this administration has been criticized about, or lack of transparency in particular. So it's definitely a positive step. A bit of a surprise, since they have been so, I think, closed off on the idea of disclosure in general. So it's definitely a step in the right direction. It seems, I think, kind of a pretty minor give in relation to some of the larger issues that are out there.
This diffuses this ongoing tension between the White House and the Office of Government Ethics, which is an office that we almost never hear of because it's so modest and doesn't do that much. To me, it's like the mouse spooking the elephant, right? The elephant shouldn't be scared, but they often are. So this may be a dawning of a new moment where we have more transparency.
Well, speaking of ethics, we've had this ongoing investigation related to activities with Russia back from the election, and it's now really kind of circulated in and moving up the proverbial food chain in the White House to bring in the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and also his senior advisor. And he apparently has been implicated as potentially the go-between for many of the high-level discussions. We're also hearing conversations that former FBI Director James Comey will be testifying next week before Congress. That will be probably the most watched congressional hearing maybe in the last, 20 years. You've got a lot of continuing churning as it relates to this Russia investigation.
Well, we have an issue, interestingly, that the president came back from Europe and from the Middle East with a lot of phone numbers. And his goal was to have different leaders call him directly on his cell phone, which could be a potential security risk.
It was interesting because a lot was made of the fact that the president, for some unknown reason, decided to not disable his location service on his cell phone. So every time the president of the United States tweeted out, you know exactly where he is. Well, I think anyone with some level of understanding would recognize that's probably not a good idea. But more than that, there are record protocols that need to be maintained. There are conversations that need to be backed up because the president is not well-versed in all subjects at all times. So very often when you're having these conversations, you'll have an expert on the line with you. If it's not going through the White House switchboard, you don't know what is said. You don't know when it's said. There's no actual record. It's a modern idea to want to have that relationship that with world leaders can be a good thing. But this is probably bordering on a really dumb idea.
Well, I think that we should just have the president conduct foreign policy by emoji, right? He'll be the first emoji president.
Well, speaking of President Trump and his desire to want to communicate via social media and directly to individuals, the question that has been on everyone's mind the last 24 hours has been, what does Cobb Fief mean? That's right. Or I prefer the term, as the way it's pronounced in French, Covfefe.
I like the more exotic pronunciation. I think it adds flair to it. Sean Spicer said that there were a select few people who know what this means, and the president was communicating to them. So we should note that you and I, Jay, are two people who know what it means. So we will announce what Confief means over the weekend on our Twitter feeds. Jay, what's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is at profjkayer.
And mine is at bjrottinghouse. We will use the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod, which is also another way you can follow along with us on the show.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk Paris Climate Accord and climate change in general.
So there's been a lot of conversation about climate change as well as the U.S.'s agreements with respect to the Paris Climate Agreement. So, Jay, what's the temperature on what's happening right now?
Yeah, temperature being the key word here, right? Climate change. Well, let's talk a little bit about there's been a lot of conversation about the Paris Accords. Kind of what are the Paris Accords? What does it really mean? What is the potential impact in terms of fighting a global threat to climate change? So the Paris Accords is an international agreement that was signed by essentially most of the countries in the world today, all but I think Syria and Nicaragua are signatories to it. And it really centers on this idea of setting voluntary limitations on carbon emissions by countries. It sets targets for you to voluntarily reduce, and it recognizes that there are differences between countries. You've got some nations that have had years to develop and have really elaborate carbon-based economies, and you have emerging markets that, generally speaking, produce and emit far less in terms of carbon dioxide emissions. The United States produces roughly about 25% of the world's emissions while being only about 5% of the population. We're one of the major contributors of carbon emissions. And so the idea behind it was to create a structure that would limit that amount.
We're not necessarily the leader, right? China is the leader by a lot. And so this was an opportunity for the U.S. and for the world to be able to reduce those emissions. I think one thing to keep in mind here is that this is as much about the environment as it is about business, as it is about Obama. And if it weren't the case that President Obama hadn't initiated this, I'm not sure we would be having this discussion. I'm not sure that the president wouldn't say as a potential win, like, let's join this and make this happen.
Sometimes it feels like everything comes back to Obama.
Yeah.
If Obama did it, I can't support it.
And this is a long-going legacy of undoing the President Obama's climate efforts, right? So that when President Trump came in, he eased oil drilling restrictions in Arctic waters. He ordered Interior to rewrite rules that had tougher environmental standards on fracking and public land. He's cut the budget of the EPA by 31%. So this is really a challenge to Obama as much as it is a challenge to the U.S.'s role in the world, which of course it also is. But what do you make of the politics of this? Is this good for the president, or is this something that is potentially damaging down the road?
When you're sort of doing the analysis on the politics, I think it's important to recognize that you've seen this growing fissure in terms of how the assumptions behind climate change and sort of science generally are perceived. The U.S. has seen this odd situation where the percentage of people who actually acknowledge climate change being a man-made occurrence is somewhat, at least among Republican primary voters, is dropping. Mm. And so there's a real divide within the Republican Party on this. And part of that is this anti-intellectual streak that seems to have developed, or at least anti-science streak. That's probably a better way of describing it, because we know there's consensus on climate change in the scientific community.
Yeah.
The politics of firm are hard because really the business community as a whole, most of the sort of external interest groups support these voluntary changes. And it's been relatively baked in because you've already seen progress in terms of clean coal power plants. You know, we've only got about 9,000 people in the coal industry, and we have about 2.5 million in solar energy. So you've got this weird sort of disconnect between the voters who put him in office and allowed him to win the Republican primary and the reality of the economic conditions. And that, I think, more than anything, affects the politics, because there is definitely a political calculus to this. And he also made a promise. I mean, he's publicly stated that he wanted to be out of the Accords, and this is, I think, what makes it so difficult.
I doubt there's much backlash from his electoral coalition, who really were the champions of this populist America First agenda, or from the business community, many of whom worried that this might stunt the ability for the U.S. to grow in terms of jobs. So if the conservative voices in the White House who've been pushing this are to be successful, they can be successful in two measures, like you say. So number one is that the White House has really pushed a kind of pro-fossil fuel energy agenda. And so this is something that probably allows that to happen more clearly. The other is that this is something that either creates jobs or stops the loss of jobs in areas the president is strong in for 2020. And I'm not convinced the president's going to run in 2020, but if he does, he understands that he needs that same coalition to come out and support him. So he cannot go back on a promise. He's already had so many broken promises that it is, I think, difficult for him to do yet another one on such a big stage.
I think the challenge, though, is that it loses, from a geopolitics perspective, the U.S.'s ability to influence other issues on a global way. What seems to end up happening is that the U.S. says, you know, Germany, Angela Merkel, you know, France, Emmanuel Macron, you lead on these sort of issues. I'm going to take a backseat. I'm going to stick to sort of America First. And I think that is the challenge here. That's what makes the process, I think, difficult for them, because as U.S. influence sort of diminishes, it becomes harder, to, at least from a business perspective, to move forward.
This is really potentially a rebuke to European leaders who directly ask the president not to withdraw from this. And so this is something for sure that is complicated. It also, I think, calls into question the potential for the president and for the U.S. to stay in these other agreements that they're a part of, not only from an environmental perspective, but also from a trade perspective. There are hundreds of these different individual treaties that may be in jeopardy because the fear is that the White House won't honor them. So how the president leaves this treaty and the mechanism by which they alter the agreements, not only this one, but also in ones in the future, will tell us a lot about how it is the president sort of sees the U.S. in terms of those kind of geopolitical roles.
And the domestic business side can't be overlooked, right? I mean, you've got a situation where he had worked very hard, I think, to, you know, get the tech community back on board with him, who understand that it's important to have a pro-business president. One of the leaders in that, Elon Musk, who sat on an advisory committee, is now saying, look, I'm going to leave. I mean, he is probably, I think, more than anyone, the commercialization of the alternative fuel industry has been led by Elon Musk, both in terms of electric cars and now adoption of solar energy. This directly sort of affects his bottom line, right? Because part of it is with the Paris Accords, but also just the way the approach to energy development has been, is there has been, under the Obama era, a direct sort of emphasis on wanting to develop alternative fuels and that entire sector globally. So you've seen massive growth, massive expansion in wind, a massive expansion in solar energy. That retreat directly affects a lot of the emerging business sector. Solar energy and wind are now cheaper in many cases, and you throw in natural gas, are far cheaper than coal and oil. And so as a consequence, when you go back to the old system, it has an effect on it. So you start losing some of these business leaders, it becomes really problematic.
And I think, too, it makes it look like the Republican Party and the Trump White House are living in the past. Their approach to energy feels like it was 20 years ago instead of 20 years in the future. So that's something I think, too, that may be problematic for them thinking ahead to the next elections, not just the presidential election, but to the midterms in 18.
Well, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, let's kind of wrap this up and talk about why this particular issue in terms of climate change matters so much.
We talked at great length about the U.S.'s role in the world and about climate change. Where does this leave us, Jay? Why should we care about this?
Great question. The long-term future of not just our country, but globally depends on really addressing this fundamental problem of climate change. We know that if you talk to the insurance industry, you talk to all major companies, they will tell you that climate change is the single biggest cost variable we have. There's a business case to be made. What's shocking to me is that the president won't embrace that. His own companies in managing their golf course properties have riders in their policies related to climate change. The business side of Donald Trump says this is a real thing. Unfortunately, the presidential political side of Donald Trump hasn't gotten that yet.
I will one up that. Scientists expect that a Delaware-sized chunk of iceberg will fall off of Antarctica as this week progresses. So it gives us two things to keep in mind. Number one, climate change is something that is critical to the world. And number two, the U.S. cannot abdicate its role in the world. And although the president may seek to modify this in some ways, the U.S. cannot back away from these obligations, regardless of the politics.
That's right. The U.S. has to remain a leader globally. Well, we'll be back next week with more Party Politics. If you like this political chatter, make sure to check out our Texas-centric episodes, too. They're available every Friday afternoon, just like these episodes. Thanks to Houston Public Media, our producers Daisha Clay, Laura Lucas, Edel Howland, and thanks to our engineer extraordinaire Todd Holtzlander.
Be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or from wherever you get your podcasts, and please leave us a review. It'll help other people find the show. Follow us on Twitter with the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod, and you can email us at partypoliticspod@houstonpublicmedia.org.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.